and Muse on Talk About Radio. You can find out more about the shows at minstrelandmuse.com. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Minstrel and Muse. I'm your host, Linda Rez, and I'm here with Sharma Shields, author of the highly anticipated and acclaimed novel, The Sasquatch Hunter's Almanac, which I've read, and I'm here to tell you, wow, it's dark, beautiful, heartbreaking, a story of love and despair, families, abandonment, or the perception of abandonment, and also hope. And it will stay with you for a long, long time, as it has me. Welcome to the show, Sharma.
Thanks, Linda. Thanks so much for saying all those kind things, too. That means a lot to me.
Well, and I don't say them lightly. When I get behind a book, that means I really love the book. And I read it and then contacted you to be on the show because one thing, I wanted to talk to someone about it. There's so much that goes on in this novel. I don't like I just have all these ideas in my head. So who better to talk to than you?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I'm your gal. I'm ready.
You're
ready to chat about it.
Let's talk about this book. How long were you writing it?
Let's see. I started the book in between my pregnancies. So I was working at the library for the county library district at the time. It was probably around 2010 when I got started in the spring. And then, let's see, I guess we probably started wrapping it up, the first draft of it, a couple years after that. I really reworked this novel. It was a huge editorial undertaking for me, and I spent probably as much time editing it as I did writing it. So it was another year or two of just kind of backbreaking deletion and rewriting and new chapters and getting rid of old chapters. And that's how it turned into the book it is now.
Mm. Well, you're from the Lilac City, the Spokane, and but Lilac City in the book, and that's what we refer to ourselves as, too. I'm also from the Lilac City, and I have read a lot about you.
I know, that's so cool.
Yeah, and it sounds to me like you give back a lot to the community, and the community gives to you as well. Did you have some people in our Lilac City help you do some of the editing and reprocessing of the book?
Well, I am part of a writing group here now, but... with this particular book, my three main editors for it were my agent, my husband, or actually four main editors, my husband, who's also a writer, we met in grad school at Montana, my brother, who is oddly, he never reads fiction ever, he's kind of a nonfiction buff, but he's just so good at reading my work and giving me really strong criticism, and positive criticism, too. It's not... too cruel. Sometimes it can be. And then a writer, friend of mine and of my husband's who lives out on the East Coast named J. Robert Lennon. And those were really the four people who helped me reshape the book. But I have gotten a ton of support from the town. And Spokane was a place I grew up. I never thought I would move back here. I left in high school and never even came back to live here again in the summers. I stayed in Seattle and then moved to Missoula for grad school. But I have been so happy since moving back here and starting my family here. And the town has been really supportive. It has a very tight-knit art scene here. And I think people are so excited to see the arts coming out in Spokane that they really get behind the artists and the writers in the community. And it's been a really fun place to kind of mingle with other artists and arts lovers. So I'm so glad I moved back here.
Oh, yeah.
Which I never thought I would say.
You really weave it into this book. And I think some of the spirit of this area, our belief in, for instance, the Sasquatch, for one thing, but also the lakes and the deep woods, and just there's a lot of mystery in the Pacific Northwest, and especially our area. And you weave all these locations into the book.
Yeah, I've really wrote about a lot of places that I love and that have had, that their beauty has kind of had this big effect on my imagination, both when I was growing up here and now, when I get out into the woods now. Mm-hmm. But the woods around here, the lakes, the Palouse area, which I think is so beautiful, just those rolling, the rolling expanse of farmland down there, I think is incredible. And, you know, the trees, the just the ubiquity of the pine trees in this area. And, you know, we live on the South Hill, which is a pretty, you know, busy place, lots of houses, lots of traffic even. But then we can drive, you know, 5 minutes and be out in the middle of nowhere, and feel completely alone in the woods. And there's all these dark shadows there and these things of beauty, but also of darkness. And I love that combination. And when I'm out walking in those landscapes, my mind really takes off. And I think a lot of what I write is born of that. And sometimes I think my love of the outdoors and playing outside as a kid is part of what made me a writer. There was something just always so mystical to me about the landscape in this area, and I loved writing about it. It was so much fun.
Well, it really adds a lot to the book. And can we talk a little bit about the book? For people who haven't read it, it's called The Sasquatch Hunter's Almanac. They're going to be confused probably, but it makes perfect sense when you read the book. Eli's a little boy that he grows up, and it's his life that's really traced through the book. But his mom leaves at the very beginning. I mean, you started right off, and that's what grabs you as a reader. There's no time wasted. His mom, you know, introduces him to this big hairy guy, Mr. Krantz, and walks out into the woods with him to never come back, or at least not for a long time. And I don't want to give too much away, though. I guess I'm very careful what I say there. But then Eli becomes a podiatrist and goes on a search to find the Sasquatch, or this big hairy guy that he saw. And his family gets brought into that, too. And they each really, there wasn't a character I didn't think it stood out more than the other, even though it's a story about Eli's journey. The stories of his daughters especially factor in just as much.
Yeah. And I felt a lot of affection for those daughters, and I really wanted them to be fleshed out pretty fully in the book. I wanted it to be as much a story of Eli's life, and I do see him as being very much the central character of the book. But I wanted to show how the things that have affected Eli and the choices that he has made, how they affect his family members as well, in particular his daughters. And also his wives. He has one who ends up kind of succumbing to a lot of fear and a lot of mental illness. And then his second wife is more supportive. And she actually had many more chapters that I had written for the book, but they ended up being cut to kind of streamline the book a little bit more. And I think that was a smart choice, but I do miss I miss her being fleshed out more as well in the book.
I really liked Vanessa's character, and I guess now my question would be, what would that have told us? What would we have gotten out of that that we didn't get?
There was one chapter in particular that I really liked, and I think even my editor really liked it at Holt, but it was kind of making the ending drag a little bit, so we ended up cutting it. But it kind of told what happened to Vanessa after Eli passes, like a couple years later. And explains how her relationship, you know, changes and also remains kind of the same with both her stepdaughter and her biological daughter. It was just a little more of a fleshing out. There was a kind of magical talking painting in that chapter that I liked, but it was one of those kill your darlings moments. But I do think it made It kind of sat in the middle of the ending like this big, speed bump, and it kind of was keeping the ending from just moving smoothly towards its conclusion. So I think it was really smart to cut it.
Well, I would see where it'd be difficult to cut anything because the characters are, they're fully realized. They each have chapters that are devoted to them. For instance, Marion. The mm-hmm. character of Marion, he's not really that, he is consequential in some ways, but he's not one of the driving forces of the book, and yet that's one of the saddest parts of the book to me. I had to get up and walk away for a while, and I couldn't read it for just a little bit. I had just to absorb what had just happened.
Yeah, I think Marion's story became kind of a good one for me to tell, because it really was about how he ends up kind of just believing in the low expectations given to him by people, and he ends up really fulfilling those low expectations rather than rising above them in a way that I think actually Amelia really does in the book, and even Ginger toward the end. So I think it was great that his story ended up being told a little bit more. And that was actually at the advice of my friend on the East Coast, J. Robert Lennon, who said, hey, you had this Marion guy. I just really want to know what happens to him. Just please add a chapter so that we can see, you know, how he disappears into Lake Roosevelt. And, you know, I spent a lot of my childhood driving up to Omak and Okanagan area to visit my grandparents and my cousin who lived up there. And it's where my mom grew up. And we would always pass by Grand Coulee Dam, and we would go and bathe in, you know, the lake and swim around and have a really fun time there and watch the light show on the dam at night. And so it was really a fun place for me to set the story, but it is a pretty scary and sad story what happens there.
Yeah, it is. I'm glad you added that. It really did. It just one more connection. I felt so connected to all the characters in the book, all of them. You know, you have the divorce, and so you have these two daughters. One is the new, and one is the old, you know, from the first marriage and from the second marriage. And then there are difficulties even in bridging the gap, you know, to come together as full sisters. They do seem to do that quite a bit towards the end.
Yeah, I mean, I think the sisters really end up connecting with one another in a way that, you know, Amelia can't even find that connection with her parents necessarily, because her parents have never really offered it to her. So it was very much a sister's story, too, as well as kind of a story about parenting gone wrong a little bit. And not gone wrong in the sense of, you know, like really physical abuse or something, but just this kind of neglect, this distraction, allowing other things to distract you from the people that you should be caring the most about in your life.
Yeah, absolutely. The start of the book, this is one of my curiosities, one of my questions. When I first started it, you know, I understood Sasquatch was going to factor in. I'd read a little bit about it, knowing there were going to be other monsters, you know, unicorn and the magic and sea monsters and stuff. So I was kind of thinking it was going to be like a old fairy tale, the ones that are dark and, you know, and really bad things happen. Nothing like our very sanitized fairy tales we have today, but the, the old primitive ones. And it is. It's like that. And then you start out here with this poem about the evil stepmother. In her old age, she's slowly dying in an empty hovel. And so I was like, okay, this is going to be like a fairy tale with just an evil stepmother in it. But it didn't really have an evil stepmother in it. Vanessa turned out to be... Mm-hmm. Not so much. I mean, if anything, it was more the biological mothers that were more on the evil stepmother side, especially Agnes. I mean, if anything, and maybe even Gladys. I'm not really sure. Mm-hmm. What were you thinking when you put that quote there?
That's so great. You are the first person that's asked me about that quote, and it's a poem that I've loved since my early 20s, and I love that poet, Honest Were. And she, I think she writes really beautifully in that little tiny poem about, you know, she kind of uses fairy tale. We immediately see the picture of the evil stepmother, and you picture the evil stepmother from like Cinderella or, you know, Snow White or any number of the fairy tales where stepmothers are pretty wicked. But what happens is at the end of the poem, she is just a person. She's kind of stripped down to just her basic mortality. And that to me is what is so beautiful about the poem, is that she's cold. I mean, it makes me as the reader want to draw a blanket over her. I mean, it's almost like this oddly affectionate poem about somebody who has, you know, spent their life maybe intentionally being wicked, but at the end of their life, they're just the same as all of us almost. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I kind of, when I originally wrote that the title was The Humanoids, and it was about things that are human and things that are not and what makes us human. And of course, the publisher really thought that that sounded more like robots than it did, you know, Sasquatch. Although I had frequently heard in my research of Sasquatch, the term humanoid being used for them, along with hominid and hominin, which becomes kind of an inside joke in the book as well. The usage of those words. But while I was writing that book, that poem kept coming back to me, and I just, I wanted to have it there for that fairy tale quality and just this like basic understanding of human life and death, and kind of what connects us and what separates us, I guess. I love that, that little tiny poem. I think it's so beautiful.
Well, that makes sense. So you weren't thinking of it as in terms of, you know, writing a book that goes along with this poem about stepmothers. It was more, you know, this poem could be applied to any of these characters. Eli, for instance.
Yeah, that's really how I saw it. And I did like it too, because it does suggest stepmother, which suggests divorce, which suggests, you know, new marriages, and all of that is very much in the book, but I didn't mean for it to reflect any one particular character. I did have a feeling though, you know, like of Amelia, who, you know, I think Vanessa has been, not the best stepmother to Amelia. And while she hasn't been evil or wicked per se, I don't think she's made the right choices regarding Amelia either. I had that thought in my mind, but it was more of a not to be taken too literally with one set character. Yeah.
Yeah. One thing that also I was very impressed with, and this is what I think makes it a great book, is that you were so honest in dealing with every character, meaning, you know, their flaws, which are just, wow, they're just out there. Like the babysitting job that Amelia did when Ginger was there. I was so stressed reading that, too. I'm like, please take care of her. Don't hurt this poor little girl. Because, you know, there's all that there, that ominous kind of, you know, overtone that she could, because she had a lot of aggression, you know, and didn't really didn't have the caring at that point. And so, but anyway, but you did, even Ginger, though, you also showed that her, you know, her anxieties and her wanting to look at life is so perfect. And then Vanessa, you even showed us a little bit about what she thought in her quiet time, and it wasn't all good. It wasn't all perfect. But that's what I really loved about the book. How did you, and why did you do it that way?
Well, I've, you know, I actually had a different interviewer contact me, and she was a younger interviewer from the University of Montana, and she was very concerned with how I had portrayed the women, because she didn't see any of them as being particularly strong or noble characters, and they were all so deeply flawed. And, you know, did I consider myself a feminist writer if I was writing women like that? And, you know, I told her, I really do, I think at my heart, I believe we are all flawed, and I'm really hard on my characters, because I am really hard on myself as a person. And I would say that all of these characters, in some way or another, are kind of almost, you know, mirrors of myself. And there's a lot of deeply autobiographical stuff. So I explore a lot of my own shortcomings, my own, you know, less than noble thoughts that I have while I'm sitting around, or, you know, things that I wish I could change about myself, or stupid things I said or did that I, you know, I can't take back and wish I could have. And, you know, regrets that I have seen in my own family life, that I can tell have tortured other people for years. And I kind of wanted to touch on those moments a little bit, because I think those are the sorts of things that we think about as we grow older, and they're the sorts of things that change us and make us, you know, try to turn into better people. So I told her that I actually think a lot of these women are strong in their own ways. You know, even Gladys, who I think, you know, has so much fear, and it's just, she's fighting against so many, you know, stereotypes about women that she's grown up with and that she thinks she has to be a certain way and act a certain way to receive respect from people. But I think all of the women in some way or another are fighting hard for something. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and I wanted that to be there, but I can't, you know, I can never write like the, wow, this character is just the perfect person, or this character is, you know, this character is, I don't know, almost like Katniss or something, like, you know,
oh,
this character is a really good archer or something. Like, I don't know. My women are much more damaged than that. It's true. But my people are, you know, I think all of the people are in my work.
Yeah,
well, I am.
I think we all are, and that's realistic. I think that in some ways it's not very heroic if you haven't had to overcome your flaws and your regrets and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes the hero out of hero, really. These characters have a lot to overcome, and they do, and I think that makes them very memorable and admirable.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I was recently talking at a university about, I read aloud the unicorn chapter where there's a character, Ginger, the younger sister, who she's grown up and she's really dealing with what I see as kind of a almost prolonged and really difficult postpartum depression, which is something I dealt with after the birth of my daughter. And there's a lot of really crazy autobiographical thoughts and even dialogue coming from that. And a very dark time, and the sort of like pitch blackness of that entire chapter is born of a very real place where I was, where it felt like everything was pitch black like that to me, you know, and that the world would be a better place if I just wasn't there, which was a really horrible way to think. And, you know, it was something I had to be treated for to get out of. And, and Ginger, you know, she ends up in that chapter, she ends up really kind of battling almost against this unicorn, the symbol of healing, in order to make things right with herself. And that's kind of what it takes, is just this, you know, fighting to find the good in the world and to stay healthy and
That whole story progressed, of course, from the eagle and the baby.
Earlier
in the book. Yeah. Do you have the book that you could read a little bit to us?
I do. Yeah.
Is there a part that you particularly would like to read? Or, I mean, that's obviously a good section. But that's another thing. Every chapter is its own story. And I know you have another collection of short stories, Favorite Monsters. Do you prefer writing in that short form, the tight short form?
Well, I wanted to do that with this particular novel because I wrote two novels before this one, and they were just rambling pieces of garbage. I mean, they just went on and on and on for hundreds of pages,
yeah.
And they didn't really have a point. Mm-hmm. And it was almost like I was trying to write a really, 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 really long short story.
Mm-hmm.
But I did feel confident in that I could write a short story. So when I decided that I was going to write another novel, and I never tried to edit those. I mean, they were so huge and rambling that I was just like, I don't even know how I would edit them. But I knew how to write a short story. I knew how to edit a short story. And I decided I would kind of tackle each chapter the way that I tackle a short story, kind of meaning that it would focus in on one character. That character would have a very specific desire, and the arc of the chapter would be whether or not that desire was met or unmet, and kind of the result of, you know, or some sort of epiphany that comes from either having their desire met or not. And that's really how the whole concept of the novel was born. And of course, what happened is after I wrote it, then I had to go back and really make sure that it could cohere as an entire arc for the entire novel, because I have all of these little dramatic arcs. And the thing that I really liked about that is I think it did kind of get rid of dead weight. I didn't have a lot of boring pages, which was good. But I did have to work really hard to make the whole thing cohere. And it does still read partially like a short story collection too. But I kind of like the quirkiness of it. I told a friend, a writer friend of mine, that, you know, I said something like, you know, my book's pretty messy. And he was like, don't call it messy, call it feral. I was like, feral. Feral's a great word.
It is a great word. That's kinda, way better than messy.
That kind of matches a lot of the thematic stuff with it too. So that was kind of funny when he said that. And I think it is. It does have this messy feral quality to it because of the technique, which I think probably drives some people nuts. But
I don't know. But you did tie everything together through all those chapters too, as far as, you know, informing us about, you know, as you're going through that new perspective, informing us about some details that were left off maybe in the chapter before. So it was all tied together. And
That definitely took some work to get there. Yeah. Well, if I read, what would you like me to read? Let's see here. Let me find something.
You choose. Well,
maybe we mentioned the chapter where the baby meets an eagle. I won't say exactly what happens, but I'll read kind of what happens in that chapter. So basically the setup for the chapter is that Ginger is Dr. Eli Roebuck, our Sasquatch hunters. It's his daughter, his youngest daughter from his second wife. And she has grown up and has married a man named Court. And they have had two children. And Court comes home and finds that his wife and his older daughter are missing from the house and the car is gone. And then he realizes that the baby is still in the house and has been left in the house completely alone. And he, understandably a little bit, feels pretty annoyed with that and starts thinking of ways to punish his wife, for doing that to his little girl. And so he puts, his daughter outside in the yard. And then when his wife returns with the toddler, who she's holding and has fallen asleep in the car, and she's gotten in the car and driven her around the block in order for her to fall asleep. He's kind of waiting to find out if she will go into the baby's room and see if the baby's asleep or not. And then he's kind of wanting her to see that she's missing and think that the baby's been stolen or something. So it's kind of this scene of a little bit of marital strife. It's also, it kind of shows how Ginger is just, she's going through a pretty hard time. She's feeling a lot of fatigue, and she's feeling, it seems like, a lot of isolation and depression too. I'll start reading from here. Still, Court did sorrow for her, his wife. He pitied her. She was exhausted, he saw. She was a wildly emotional person. He liked it about her, in fact, but it meant that she was prone to irrationality, to terrible mood swings and paranoia. Clearly, this had been a deeply irrational moment, dangerous. He wandered over to the window again and checked on Ruby. She was still there, straight-lipped, alert, content enough. The eagle was still there, too. He thought of showing the eagle to his wife, but then surely she would see their daughter, and the lesson would be spoiled. And I should add here that earlier in the chapter, he sees an eagle sitting on the top of a telephone pole, just kind of checking the scene out. Mm-hmm. Should we check on Ruby, he said. Go ahead, his wife said. She'll cry if she needs us. He sat back down on the couch. He was growing anxious. Much longer and Ruby might grow cold. Tell me about the hospital, Ginger said. More assholes? More D-bags? He told her quickly that nothing much had happened, but the day had been, overall, a pleasant if busy affair, and that he was really just happy to be home. I'm happy, too, Ginger smiled. I feel like it's the first time we've been able to just talk to each other, without the kids, I mean. She looked around herself as if gazing at new surroundings. Isn't it nice? It was nice, but he was becoming anxious, so he avoided a verbal response. It was as if Ginger knew, as if she were toying with him. How was it that she always managed to win their battles? How was it that she always, despite everything, triumphed? But then she said, rising suddenly, her maternal instincts flaring, Ruby doesn't usually sleep this long. She went toward the hallway and disappeared into the infant's quiet green room. Court held his breath, waiting. What would she do when she saw that the child was missing? Walk into the room, pale and speechless, sprint for the phone to call 911? What would happen? He feared and desired it equally. It suddenly occurred to him that she might immediately accuse him. Her wrath would fall on him and the lesson would be for naught. If that happened, he decided, he'd play dumb for a few moments, feigning panic himself. She returned then, unsmiling. She's fine, she said. She's glorious. What a good baby. Sleeping away. She collapsed back into the recliner, threw her forearm over her eyes again and sighed contentedly, drawing her beer up to her lips. Court stood and began nervously pacing. He wanted to check the nursery, too, to see what it was that Ginger had seen, but he dared not. He remained with her in the living room. He sidled up alongside the window and looked outside. There was Ruby, still on her swaddle blanket in the grass, beginning, he could see, to flail about and whine. Had Ginger seen the child on her way into the house? Maybe she had peered over the gate and noticed her lying on the grass, deciding then and there to boomerang Court's lesson back to him. Maybe there was a bear or a pillow or a blanket in the crib that looked like a sleeping baby's form? Or did she see a corner of the baby's blanket from Ruby's bedroom window, realizing immediately what Court had done? Court wanted to ask, wanted to yell, really, to scream at his wife. And it occurred to him that he had wanted to scream and to yell at her for many days now, and that he had finally found a good reason to do so. His eyes lifted from his daughter to the telephone pole. The eagle was gone. And then the eagle was there again, falling, diving murderously toward the open yard. Court moved to the back door, filled with an intense concern. He had just stepped up to the stairs when the eagle nearly struck him with her wide black wings. She drew the infant in with her ugly ancient talons and with some difficulty lifted her into the air, swaddle blanket and all. Court shrieked, leaping for the child. The eagle danced in midair, finding it difficult to rise with her heavy purchase. "My baby," Court yelled, "my little girl." Ginger joined him, still grasping her beer. She seemed neither worried nor startled by the episode, but only watched the scene unfold with a sort of mute resolve, as if she had expected it all along. "This, too," she seemed to be thinking, "this, too, is my fault." Why had he tried to blame her when she already blamed herself for so much? Court hated himself for it, and he focused his hatred on the eagle. He grabbed the baby's chubby legs, bloody now, and he pulled against the eagle with all of his might. The eagle flapped her wings. The baby wailed. The eagle turned her big head toward Court and pecked at his fingers. "I'm not letting go, you fucker," he cried. "Don't," Ginger said. She came forward and put her thumbs in the eagle's eyes. "Don't let go. Whatever you do, Court, keep fighting." She could have been talking about anything. The baby, his career, their marriage. Her voice was calm and clear. Court obeyed his wife. He fought. He had never fought so hard for anything in his whole life. He was determined just this once to win. Hmm. Yeah, yep. So that's the end of
very
that
nice.
Chapter.
Thank you. One of many tense moments that arise in the novel.
Yeah.
Now, I imagine you have, I'm going to be letting you go here a little bit. I've already kept you longer than I said I was going to, but I have so much more to ask you, but I am going to, I'm going to start making my way out of here now, so you can.
Sure.
But Do you have a lot in common with both these two girls? Because you sound to me like what Amelia sounded like as I was reading the novel. I had a voice in my, I always have voices in
oh,
my
funny.
Mind when I hear. And you have the voice I imagined with Amelia.
Yeah, I think all of my characters to some degree have something. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, I thought my kids were shrieking in pain, and I just realized they're laughing really hard. So sorry, totally got distracted. they're laughing with joy, so that's
good.
Okay.
Good.
Phew. I know. I kind of went still for a moment listening there. I am definitely in these girls and in all of my characters. I think a lot of my voice and my experience comes out in them. And that was maybe one reason I chose to write Amelia's chapter that takes place in the Electric City. I chose to write that in first person because I really felt like I could access some of my emotions from when I was 14 and or 15 and just, you know, kind of feeling sort of indifferent with boys, but sort of trying it out and not really, you know, enjoying the experience per se, but also kind of going with it. And a lot of that, you know, is very true to things I experienced, even though the literal things that happened in that story, of course, are completely fictionalized. But a lot of the emotions are really very real to me. And I think that's one reason I love magic realism and using that is because I feel like it does give me some sort of, like, you know, enchanted cape to throw over my shoulders so you know, I could kind of hide the hyper reality of my emotions under this, like, crazy fantastical thing so no one will be like, wow, this lady's a total nut, or or wow, this is an pretty autobiographical work. It's actually pretty nice to have those kind of flights of fancy and give myself some distance. So I think I can tackle those things and in a way find even more honesty with them than I would if I were writing, you know, a memoir or something.
Absolutely. Well, I'm interested in reading your memoir, too. So when you write that, let me know. Anyone who can write the Sasquatch Hunter's Almanac with all of its complexity must be a pretty fascinating person. So I'll look forward to the memoir. But thank you so much for joining me today. I kept you longer than I said I was going to, but I could have talked to you all day long. I just appreciate that I had this chance. And this book is fantastic. I hope it just continues to sell and do really well for you and become one of our American classics. Certainly, it'll be an American classic at the very least. But beautiful work. Thank you. And you have a nice day.
Well, this has been a really fun conversation, Linda. I hope we stay in touch.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, you have my email, so email me anytime something's going on. And
okay, great. I will.
I'll be looking for you around town, around Lilac City.
Okay, all right, awesome. Sharma. Are you on Facebook and stuff?
Yeah, I am on Facebook. I've liked your page and everything. Great. So I'll put some of my contact information.
I'll look for you and send you and stuff. Yeah, cool. Okay.
Awesome. Well, you have fun with this book.
Okay, thanks so much for that.